are magnificently designed machines, and we're designed to get our nutrients through the gastrointestinal tract. That's how it works. So I would say bypass that, either because of acute need or at your peril. I mean, you know, you're inviting the law of unintended consequences.
Dr. David Katz, head of Yale's Prevention Research Center, talking about the rise of those storefront IV drip places. You know, feel great, get that healthy glow with a vitamin infusion. We're going to hear all about that in a few minutes, even go along on a trip to one of these little clinics. First, though, today is the deadline for the Trump administration to reunite the children and parents who were separated at the border. The government is working to get as many of them back together as possible under orders from a federal judge, but it will not be reuniting them all. Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he covers immigration. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. How many kids are now waiting in detention centers and waiting to be reunited with their parents?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but it seems that at the very least, there's got to be maybe just shy of 1,000, in that the government has said there are close to 900 parents who are not yet deemed eligible to be reunited with their kids. And so for as long as there are questions about these parents, kids are still in limbo, waiting for more.
And then some parents have already been deported or have left the country, right?
That's right. So what the government has done is it said, okay, there are about 900 parents who are either ineligible to be reunited immediately with their kids or are not yet known to be eligible. And so under that heading, there are about 450 parents who seem to have already been deported without their children. So the government is saying, look, we can't, there's nothing we can do with them immediately. Obviously, we can't make the deadline with these parents because they're no longer in the country. But that is obviously a staggering number. I mean, over 450 parents who are now no longer here and presumably whose kids remain here and now need to figure out what to do.
And what are they going to do about those kids?
It's not entirely clear what the government is prepared to do. I know there is a network of NGOs and advocacy organizations that are really picking up the slack and doing work in the region, mostly in Central America, to try to partner with local organizations in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, to try to piece together information about where her parents might be and how they can then begin this process of reunification. The judge who's presiding over this case has instructed the government to avail itself of the help of advocates, and the government has obviously seemed to drag its feet so far, so it's really going to look like the lion's share of the work will be done by advocates on the ground, both in the U.S. and in Central America, and that we're hoping that's done in some consultation with the government. The government's willing to accept the help of these advocates.
So it's increasingly become clear that the government did not have a plan, really, to reunite these families.
That's correct. They began separating parents and children at the border without any plan, not only for how to keep track of parents and kids while they were in U.S. detention, but without a plan, too, to begin to anticipate all of these different permutations that we're seeing now, problems of parents and kids who have gotten disconnected, deported without their kids. How then do you begin to piece that stuff together? I mean, none of these outcomes seem to have been thought through at all by the government.
And it also appears that the federal judge, Judge Dana Sabra, is pretty fed up with the government in this whole process. What are some of the things that he can do to, I don't know, punish the government for doing this?
Well, he's in kind of a complicated position right now, because on the one hand, he wants the government to do everything it possibly can as soon as it possibly can. And so he's loath to penalize the government kind of midstream, because he wants the government to continue to do more. Yet by the same token, obviously, he's issued this order and there are specific deadlines and the government is responsible for complying with them. One thing he can obviously do in the short term, and it is going to be a kind of a major fight now and something we should all be paying a lot of attention to, is to protect parents who have what's called a final order of removal for their deportation, who are now slated to be reunited with their kids, but who, because of this final order, can be immediately deported even after they've met their kids. And so what the judge can do and what the ACLU and other advocacy organizations involved in this litigation have asked the judge to do is to issue a stay of deportation for these parents to buy them some time, at least a week, so they can begin to weigh their options. Okay, if they've got a final order for their own removal, what do they do with their kids? Do they let their kids stay here and continue to fight their own immigration cases? Do they agree to be deported together? Obviously, these are hugely complex decisions. What the ACLU is saying is that these families need sufficient time to weigh such complex decisions. The government is saying, look, these parents and kids have had enough time as is to figure out what they want to do. It will be up to the judge to figure out whether or not there is a way of at least fending off the immediate threat of deportation in these cases for these parents covered by his order.
And when will the judge decide on that?
We're waiting right now.
Okay.
To hear exactly how this plays out.
All right. So it could happen any minute now.
Presumably, yeah. I mean, last night, the ACLU filed a brief and a number of affidavits describing how many parents were in detention who had signed away either their right to be reunited with their kids or who agreed, basically, to be deported, thinking that in so doing, they were maybe going to hasten the reunion with their kids. And the attempt that the ACLU is making now is to appeal to the judge to show him just how chaotic things have been in detention centers and just how urgent it is for him to act to give these families one last small measure of protection for the time being.
And some of these parents I've read didn't know what they were signing when they were signing their own deportation orders. Maybe they didn't speak the language. They don't speak Spanish. They speak in sort of a native indigenous language.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many ways. I mean, there are the cases of parents who had either a shaky grasp of Spanish, shaky grasp of English, who were presented documents in English and couldn't understand them. Of course, there's the general situation of basically being separated from their children and told, look, if you comply with us, we can allow you to see your kids faster. And so there was just a general state of total confusion and duress and upset. Some of the cases that the ACLU team laid out in these affidavits shows pretty systematic cases of deception and manipulation and intimidation inside these detention facilities, which is a hugely concerning thing. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously fair to say that so many of these parents, while in detention, while in a state of total grief and anxiety, having to separate with their kids, didn't even fully understand what it was they were agreeing to. And myself, I've spoken to a number of them, and they all describe various sort of stages of confusion, upset, desperation, and now, of course, the consequences for those moment-by-moment decisions are starting to play out.
Well, meanwhile, what's happening to families who are trying to come in, who are at the border on the other side and are claiming asylum?
Well, I mean, this is part, the key way to understand what the family separation policy has been about all along is to understand it in the context of how this administration is trying to crack down on asylum practice more generally. And so what the government said, the sort of justification it tried to provide for separating families in the first place was that these families haven't come to the U.S. the right way to seek asylum. The right way, according to the government, would be to cross the border at a so-called port of entry, wait online, wait for a Customs and Border Protection officer to hear your claim and to process your papers and so on. And what's happening increasingly is that people are being turned away at ports of entry as well. And so the very idea that, okay, if parents had come through the border the right way, they would have a different outcome is very plainly not the case because the government is doing, it seems, its very best to keep people even from crossing in that more legitimate way.
Is this all having a deterrent effect? Because I think that was stated as one of the goals.
That's right. And it's not shown to have any deterrent effect.
Jonathan Blitzer, he covers immigration for The New Yorker. Thanks.
Thanks again.
All right, let's talk about tech and business now. Facebook might not be so unstoppable after all. Its stock dropped nearly 20% today. That's about $120 billion in market value. All because, while still making a profit, it wasn't as profitable as analysts had expected. April Glazer writes about tech for Slate. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, this sounds like a big loss, $120 billion in market cap. Is it a lot for Facebook for such a big company?
It is a lot of money. I think $120 billion is a lot of money no matter who you are. It's a ridiculously large amount of money. The thing is, though, is that Facebook's revenue still did climb 42% this quarter from the same time last year. So although, analysts were responding to the fact that Facebook missed their expectations, which was to hit $13.3 billion in revenue for the quarter, instead they hit $13.2 billion. You know, and that caused the stock to take a plunge. It's not necessarily that Facebook is not doing great.
Why the huge fall off then? If an increase of 42%, that also sounds incredible year over year in revenue. Why wasn't Wall Street cheering?
Because, you know, for one, Facebook has seen stagnation with its monthly user count, right? So we've seen 185 million or so active users on Facebook this quarter. We saw the same number last quarter. The quarter before, I think, was 184 million. And we've seen this plateau. And that means that Facebook isn't necessarily growing, right? So either they're losing users at the same number that they're gaining them, or they're not getting new ones. And that shows that Facebook might not have bright prospects later on. It's really hard to know also, though, how its kind of litany of turmoils that it's gone through over the past 2 years is going to affect the company at the end of the year, particularly after the elections this time.
Well, do we know why people aren't signing up? Do we know the reason behind that? Could it be just that young people don't think it's cool?
You know, that could be it. I mean, teens might not be joining Facebook. We also don't know the growth numbers for Instagram, another Facebook property, which might be on the rise. They don't break those up. But, you know, what the main reason is that Facebook has had so many bad headlines, right? Whether it is from, you know, dealing with Alex Jones and InfoWars and, you know, the kind of scourge of fake news on the platform, to Russians instrumentalizing Facebook, to the Cambridge Analytica privacy crisis that exposed how the company had been mishandling user data for years. You know, they are understandably in some hot water right now, and people might be understandably reticent to open a new Facebook account if they were considering doing so before.
Yeah. Well, what is its explanation for keeping someone like Alex Jones on Facebook and giving him a prominent place on Facebook? And here's a guy who regularly spews lies, really hurtful, hateful lies at that. Why doesn't Facebook just ban him?
Well, you know, Facebook is kind of making the slippery slope argument, right? Where, you know, of course it's okay to be wrong sometimes. I mean, if I was to post a news article on my private account and I get a detail wrong, you know, should Facebook ban me? The argument, though, for banning Alex Jones is that he has a verified news channel, right? Kind of this media channel. And, you know, he actually controls two pages, his own personal page and the InfoWars page. Facebook, though, is saying that to ban Alex Jones would mean that would kind of give them too much power over controlling speech on the platform in general. And, you know, others are saying there has to be some sort of strike rule here, because clearly, you know, Alex Jones has perpetuated a number of very dangerous and hateful lies. And Facebook is trying to do as little as possible here, because I think they fear that doing any more is going to force them to be more of a speech police than they would prefer to be.
What about in general with tech and tech stocks? Netflix also had some problems with its earnings lately. And, you know, the so-called FANG index, as they call it, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google. How are they all doing?
Well, Alphabet is doing, you know, they're doing fine, although they got hit with a $5.1 billion fine by European regulators earlier this month. They still took in $26.2 billion in revenue this quarter, right? And that's up 25% from the same time last year.
Oh, Alphabet, that's Google. That's the company that owns Google.
Yes, yes. You know, Netflix is definitely dealing with the fact that it has so many shows and it's trying to figure out kind of what its sweet spot is. But more than anything, there has been just a huge rush of skepticism around the tech industry that's come in since the election. And a lot of that has had to do with the kind of litany of negative headlines that have been generated. And these companies that kind of used to be the darlings of American industry, where people thought that, you know, they were really doing a lot of good for the world and that America was on top, are now starting to be seen in perhaps a less generous light.
April Glazer, she writes about tech for Slate. Thanks, April.
Thanks.
Coming up, a surprising side effect of the pill. One woman discovers it can cause sex to be painful. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, we're going to talk about sex now. Painful sex. Allison Behringer was in a serious relationship with her boyfriend, Luke, and then she started experiencing pain during intercourse. It got worse. They eventually had to stop, and that put a strain on the relationship. So she went to a gynecologist, and she told her, well, she was fine, and lots of women have pain during sex. Allison decided that was unacceptable, and she went to see another doctor who told her the pain might be due to her birth control.
And I start getting more and more angry at Luke for not being more understanding, at the first doctor I saw, angry about all the things I didn't know and the things I still don't understand. I think my biggest question is, like, now that I know, taking synthetic hormones every day for years seems like an obvious suspect for a sex-related problem. And so how is it that I never, ever suspected that the pill could be the culprit?
Well, her own story became the inspiration for a new podcast KCRW debuted this week. It's called Bodies, and it looks at how women are treated by the medical establishment. And Allison Behringer joins me now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So good news that you found out what the culprit was, right? So were you relieved?
I think it was a kind of relief, but also a relief that comes with, okay, what's next? And it was a bit of a long road to get better, but I think that there was initially relieved, and then soon after, as you can hear in the tape, really frustrated about mm-hmm. how come I didn't know this earlier.
And how come we women in general didn't know this? Because so many women are on the pill, and we're not told that this could be a possible side effect.
Yeah. I mean, that question really hits at the big question of the podcast of Bodies. Why don't we know ourselves better? Why don't we have this information? I think a lot of it has to do with historically sexism in medicine. In the case of the birth control pill, if you look back at the early history of it, you know, there were women who were tested without their knowledge and consent. And the earliest form of the birth control pill, there were a lot of side effects, actually, early on in the testing. But because it was so effective, because it was this magic pill that was going to liberate women and they could control their own reproduction, they were like, all right, let's take it. We found the magic pill without really taking into account the side effects. And that led to a congressional hearing in 1970. And they called a bunch of physicians to testify, but they didn't actually call any women who were affected by the pill.
And so were you surprised to learn the history of the pill and the federal regulation of it?
Yeah, I was definitely surprised to learn that. I mean, I think that growing up, the pill, you know, I remember not even putting it on intake forms at the doctor. You just assume that this thing is something we all take and it doesn't affect us. And, you know, I end up telling my story a lot to friends, strangers I meet at bars. This topic comes up a lot when you work on a subject matter like this. And when I tell people the punchline, basically, of the whole story, that the birth control pill was causing painful sex, there's two reactions. One is, yep, no surprise, that happened to me, that happened to my friend, I had another bad side effect. Or it's, oh, no way, I never, ever, ever knew that. And I think that speaks to, again, one of the big parts of Bodies is that the information is not out there unless you yourself have experienced it or one of your friends happened to tell you. And that's kind of the aim of the podcast, too, by sharing these stories. I think that, you know, if knowledge isn't getting out in different ways, we really have to tell stories with one another. And I just want to also mention that the only reason that I figured out the cause of my painful sex was a great doctor who I eventually saw. But the reason that I knew to go to him, the reason I suspected that the pill could have been the cause, was because another woman, a friend of mine, confided in me that she had had painful sex and told me the cause and recommended this doctor. So it's happened in my story. It happens again and again and again in all the women I've spoken to, where the answer often lies in conversations with friends. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, we're trying to do with Bodies, is have this be a conversation among friends, with the goal of really, really making a difference in how women speak about their bodies.
So that's the first episode. And will you be looking at other ailments that don't involve sex or
yes.
the reproductive area?
Yeah. So there are some more reproductive area mysteries to look out for. But there is also the third episode is something that affects men and women. And it's hard to talk about the episodes too much without giving away the mystery itself. But episode three looks at the ways in which something manifests differently in men and women comparatively. And again, because science has been so focused on men and boys, we don't see the ways in which certain illnesses, conditions manifest in women. I think a great example, small example of this, is that the symptoms for heart attack in women are much different than men. But because we've always studied men in trials, men are writing the rules here, and people die. Like, this is a serious, mm-hmm. serious thing that we really need to be thinking critically about.
I know. I don't think a lot of people realize that heart disease is the number one killer of women. People think it must be mm-hmm. breast cancer, but it's not.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's so many examples when you look across medicine of this phenomenon repeating itself. I really hope that there's going to be a community that lives beyond the podcast. I see it just these six episodes as just the starting point for all these conversations.
Okay, great. And so you can get Bodies wherever you get your podcasts, right? iTunes
yes.
or what have you.
Yes.
Great. Allison Berenger, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, is it good for you to get an IV drip infusion of vitamins and minerals if you're feeling a bit run down?
Now we move into the realm of the Tom Brady's and the Gwyneth Paltrow's who feel fine but are just looking for a little bit more. You know, it couldn't hurt. Well, there, I disagree.
The IV vitamin drip trend, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Maybe you've seen this on Instagram, people sitting around with an IV in their arms. Not in a hospital or a clinical setting. They're getting their IV drip maybe at home, maybe in a posh lounge, sometimes at a hotel or at a big party. What they're doing is called micronutrient therapy or intravenous therapy, and it's a growing phenomenon. There are storefront clinics set up where you can get an infusion on the way to Pilates or whatever. Well, our intrepid producer, Yael Evan Orr, pitched this story as part of our wellness series. And so she got to be our guinea pig, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, were you happy to do it? You seemed a little scared.
I was happy at first, and then the day before, I got pretty scared. I was just thinking, what if something goes wrong, and there was no reason for me to do it, right? I'm a healthy person, and if something went wrong, I just couldn't, like, forgive myself.
Well, you did it for journalism. You did it for the listeners.
That's true.
Okay, so let's take a listen.
So I went to a place in Santa Monica. It's close to our studios, and it's called Infuse Wellness. It's a storefront next to a bank and a secondhand store. Inside, it looks kind of like a hair salon.
I'm Dr. Magali.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
The doctor is nice, businesslike, but the forms are definitely medical and a little scary to me.
Any allergies to any medicines?
No.
Okay. Do you take any prescription medicines?
No.
And then she starts going over the menu of IV treatment options.
If it's your first time here and your first time getting a vitamin IV, I recommend the classic cocktail, which is a nice introductory IV.
But I wasn't there to mess around. The journalist in me wanted the hard stuff, or at least a slightly harder option.
The other thing that we spoke about was the Jet Set. That is an IV that has more vitamin C compared to the classic cocktail. You get a little bit more of the B vitamins. Other antioxidants similar to vitamin C are selenium and zinc, and those are in these IVs as well.
Dr. Magania's assistant takes my blood pressure, and then, moment of truth.
So make a fist, and you can look or not look, whatever makes you most comfortable.
I'm not looking.
Totally fine. Good.
We're in?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then she monitors my reaction to the IV. Do I smell something weird? Is my arm hurting? Do I feel warm inside? Am I uncomfortable? How uncomfortable? From 1 to 10. I don't remember all the questions. I'm just hoping I'm answering right. There's a needle in my arm. And then, for the next 30 minutes or so, I just sit there. Me and the drip. I watch the yellow liquid in the 250 milliliter bag slowly going down the tube. Dr. Magania did explain to me that they're using the slowest method possible since...
We have the luxury of time.
And time is abundant here. Dr. Magania says she designed her clinic to be calm, serene, the opposite of the ER where she worked for 12 years. It looks like a spa, and my room is private. It has lovely colors and a super comfy leather chair. And while the bag is emptying, I'm not really thinking about what's going into my bloodstream, about the needle or the metallic taste I get in my mouth from the magnesium. I just feel kind of calm.
Okay, so you're back now. And I will say, when you returned to the office right after, you did seem calm and glowy. How did you feel?
I felt good after. I think mostly it was a very fun experience for me. And when I got back and you asked me, like, why was it fun? I realized that it was just like a full hour when I got all this attention from the doctor, from her assistant. And basically it was a kind of attention where they really cared about how I felt and they were trying to make me feel even better.
Yeah.
And it just
felt... So it may not have been what was going into your vein. It might have been what was going on outside.
Yeah, I think definitely it was nice to be there because it felt like I'm taking care of myself and I'm being taken care of. And I think thinking about it more, that seems to be, you know, something that is in the core of any wellness trend, right? You're like, you feel good about making yourself better and making yourself feel better. But I will say I did feel better in the week after. I slept better and I was in a pretty good mood.
So are you thinking that there might be something to this? What did you have in the jet set?
I had vitamin C, B vitamins. I had some other minerals that I can't remember their
Selenium,
names.
Selenium, I think, is one of them.
And the big thing for the jet set is this thing called glutathione. I hope I pronounced it right. Which they give you kind of separately. And it's supposed to be this, like, master antioxidant that apparently is good for your brain as well.
Oh, did you feel smarter?
I don't know if I felt smarter, but I definitely, you know, when you get better sleep, you're functioning better. So
right.
I was looking back after about a week. I didn't think about it too much. And then I was like, oh, I did have a pretty good week. So maybe there is something to it.
Okay. How much did that cost, your good week?
It cost $155. The cheapest option, yeah. The cheapest option, the classic one, was $110. So basically when I looked around different places, I couldn't find anything that was under $100. So it's not cheap.
It's not cheap. Wellness doesn't come cheap, I guess, when it comes in your vein. Okay, well, we wanted to get an expert opinion. Not that we don't value your opinion, Yale, but we're going to call up a doctor, and his name is Dr. David L. Katz. He's the director of the Prevention Research Center at Yale University. He's a specialist in integrative medicine, and that's where they blend alternative therapies with traditional medical care. He says IV treatments aren't new.
In the world of alternative medicine or natural medicine, there is longstanding use of intravenous nutrient cocktails, in particular one known as the Myers cocktail, and that's just a particular formulation of B vitamins and vitamin C and certain minerals. And it has been used to treat chronic pain, chronic fatigue. When I first learned about this from one of my naturopathic colleagues, I said, well, what's the evidence that this actually works? And we looked at the literature together, which is what we always do, and we found nothing. So there was this long-standing use in naturopathic circles. There was this belief that a lot of patients were benefiting, but there was no randomized trial, and of course that's what we like to have. So we ran one. We actually wrote a grant to the NIH, my colleagues and I, and we ran the first ever placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized trial of Myers cocktail, and we used it specifically to treat fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain syndrome, as you know, that's very hard to treat, mm-hmm. and where conventional medicine doesn't typically do very well. And what we found in this small pilot study is that the Myers cocktail did make people feel better. And we measured feeling better in a variety of validated objective ways. On the other hand, just participating in the trial and getting an intravenous placebo also made people feel better.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Myers cocktail outperformed the placebo, but not by enough to make it statistically significant. There was a trend toward net benefit from the treatment. And because the results were a bit murky, we found it nearly impossible to get follow-up funding and do a larger study and figure out one way or another for sure, does this make a difference in fibromyalgia? We were very interested in doing that, but you know, sometimes you can't play because you can't get the money. So we published our paper in 2009, and it's just kind of hung out there. So I think there is benefit in certain contexts. We really don't know for sure.
Okay, so even if there isn't convincing evidence that it would work, is there convincing evidence that shows it is harmful? I mean, why not try it if it's not particularly harmful?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And so we're sort of shifting gears here, Madeline, because, you know, on the one hand, we could be talking about a patient. Someone actually has a medical condition. They're trying, they just want to feel better.
Yeah.
And the conventional treatments aren't meeting their needs. Now we move into the realm of the, you know, the Tom Brady's and the Gwyneth Paltrow's who feel fine but are just looking for a little bit more. You know, I want to glow, that kind of thing. So, you know, it couldn't hurt. Well, there I disagree. First of all, we're talking about inserting an intravenous line. Minimally, there's the risk of bleeding, infection, and bruising. But we could go a step further. That vessel that you're puncturing has to heal, and sometimes that process of sealing that hole in the blood vessel produces a blood clot, and that's called phlebitis.
How often does that happen?
Well, it's not rare. Even if it happens one time in 100 or 200 IVs, if the need for the treatment is very questionable, that risk-benefit ratio starts to become concerning. And by the way, that's how we think in medicine. Everything we do carries risk. But you know, if you really need intravenous antibiotics, if it's going to save your life, a 1 in 100 or a 1 in a 200 risk of superficial phlebitis is a risk well worth taking. But if we're not even sure what you're doing is of any value to you, and there's a 1 in 100 or 1 in a 200 risk, I'm not sure that risk is worth taking. So there's bleeding, infection, blood clot. Then there's also the fact that you can have an allergic reaction to something being put into your bloodstream that's supposed to enter your body through your mouth. And in fact, you know, there are times when we have to give intravenous or intramuscular nutrients, and that's one of the things we worry about. You really can get reactions even to what seem like compounds that should be perfectly safe, like iron.
Because
that,
it's all of a sudden in your bloodstream.
Exactly.
And it just overwhelms you.
Yep. Yeah. And it's just not a natural process. And I think people really need to appreciate that. We are magnificently designed machines, and we're designed to get our nutrients through the gastrointestinal tract. That's how it works. So I would say bypass that, either because of acute need or at your peril. I mean, you know, you're inviting the law of unintended consequences. Now, the counter argument, Madeline, I think tends to be, yeah, but, you know, I have a friend who has a friend who has a cousin who did it and felt great. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the arguments all circle back.
Well, our producer did that, and she actually said, and she was pretty skeptical because she's a journalist, but she went in and got one of these Myers cocktails, as you've described, with the B vitamins, the C, the minerals, and some other stuff, and she said she felt great for a week.
She felt great. Is this Yael?
It is.
Yes, yes. So Yael and I were talking about this story, and she told me she was going to do that. But I didn't get the punchline, so she did feel great. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that typically that's the argument. So I got it, and, you know, I got this infusion, and I felt great for however long. And that might be an indication that there is value in this. On the other hand, if you are kind of dragging and you need a boost of energy, amphetamines will transiently make you feel a lot better. Cocaine will transiently make you feel a whole lot better.
And then a whole lot worse.
Well, and then a whole lot worse.
Yeah.
That's the point. What feels good in the short term does not define what is actually good for us over time. And if we can just kind of develop this concept of, hey, I'm going to get an intravenous infusion of something to, you know, to sort of top me off and, you know, kind of get me revved up. Well, how about a blood transfusion? I guarantee you
that will
work.
Well, people do that.
So there we can talk about a wider array of very serious risks, both in the short term, but actually transfusions over time raise the risk of all sorts of autoimmune reactions, iron overload syndromes. There are all sorts of toxicities associated with it. So again, if you had to do it, if it was saving your life, yes, definitely. But if we don't know that there's any meaningful benefit, or the benefit is just, you know, I felt better right after doing it, it becomes very debatable. So whether it's a blood transfusion or cocaine as a pick-me-up, it might feel good today. That doesn't mean it's a good idea.
So you're equating these IV drips with cocaine.
I'm not. So that's the next thing I was going to say. So, you know, I think the similarity is one of kind but not degree. You know, if you told me, look, I'm going to do one of two things to feel a bit better today. I'm, you know, because I heard this guy Katz on NPR, so I'm I'm either going to do some cocaine or I'm going to get IV nutrients at this clinic down the street. So get the IV nutrients.
Well,
so I'm
one
not
is cheaper
them.
Than the other. I'm not saying it's the IV drip.
Yeah, I don't know. And that so that actually, and that's the next point we have to come to. So I'm not equating them in terms of magnitude of risk or the nature of the effect, but they are alike in the fact that, you know, they may make you feel good right now. That might be a placebo effect. It might just be the infusion of fluid. A lot of people go around slightly dehydrated. If you remember the study that we ran, and this was in fibromyalgia, this was not in people just, you know, trying to glow like Gwyneth, but we found that just giving people a placebo by IV, so a bit of IV fluid, made them feel better too. It relieved their pain and they had a bit more energy. So, you know, maybe we're dealing with a population of, you know, folks who go around dehydrated, and the answer would be to drink a bit more water, and we're solving that with infusions, you know, into their veins.
Dr. David L. Katz is the director of the Prevention Research Center at Yale University. Okay, our IV therapy guinea pig producer Yael Evan Orr is here to wrap it up. Do you think you'll do it again?
I think I'll do it again if someone is going to pay for it.
$155?
Yes. Or the $110. I can go for the classic too. But I wouldn't do it regularly.
No.
No.
We'd have to give you a big raise.
Exactly.
All right. Yael Evan Orr, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Warren Olney, host of To the Point, the podcast. Hi.
Hi. We are going to be talking to Rob Rogers, formerly of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, about the high cost of editorial cartooning. He got fired after 25, 26 years, something like that, with the paper, during which time he was always allowed to express his own views. All of a sudden, the publisher said, no, I'm sorry, I'm in favor of Donald Trump, and I don't like what you're doing. And he did one very famous one using the family crossing the road near the border that you see on the highway.
Oh, the warning signs,
with,
yeah, near San Diego.
Donald Trump reaching out and grabbing the child.
Oh.
We're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about a favorite of mine, which is political cartooning in the funny papers. And there's a lot of it. It's a very sophisticated, very interesting art form, and we're going to have some fun with that.
The funny papers, meaning like the Sunday comics?
You got it.
Okay.
The daily comics.
Think of like Family Circus, but there's actually something happening.
Well, that's one of them, yeah.
All right. Warren Olney, and To the Point, it's a podcast. Download it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Okay.
Coming up, Max Richter has composed an 8-hour piece of music, which he'll play in Grand Park this weekend to lull hundreds of people to sleep. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, this Friday and Saturday night, 560 cots will be laid out in Grand Park downtown. And for $60 or $80, you can claim one of them and spend the night listening or sleeping to this music. It's called Sleep. It's an 8-hour-long piece written by English composer Max Richter, who has written a lot of music for film and TV. He's the composer for the HBO show Leftovers. He calls sleep a personal lullaby for a frenetic world. Max Richter is in town for the performance, and he joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
I feel so calm.
Oh, great.
So peaceful now. It is very good. Peaceful music. How did you go about composing music for the idea of an 8-hour-long sleep?
I mean, the piece has its origins really in my own kind of experience, really. A kind of data saturation. You know, our world is very, very 24/7. We're always on. We're kind of glued to our screens. It's increasingly difficult to find rest, both just in our daily lives and also sleep. You know, sleep itself is being eroded. We're chronically sleep deprived. So I wanted to make a piece which would offer the opportunity to find, yeah, a moment of repose, a moment of rest.
Well, you'll be performing during this entire 8 hours, right?
Sure.
You play the piano?
I do.
So how do you stay awake in the evening hours?
What happens with this is it's a little like extreme sports, is that you have to kind of get prepared for basically a marathon performance. So I shift my sleep patterns around so that for me, when I walk on the stage, it's morning. So I've literally just had breakfast and I've done all my like morning stuff. You know, a bit of stretching and listen to the breakfast show and drunk tea. And then I go on the stage.
Even though it's dark out.
Good morning. And then I go to work. So that's how we do it. Yeah.
It starts at 10:30.
Yep.
And so for you, that'll be the morning.
That's morning.
Mm-hmm. And everyone else will be arrayed on these cots, mm-hmm. presumably not sleeping at first, mm-hmm. but getting ready to sleep.
Yeah.
Do you think that everyone will eventually fall asleep?
I think most people, they nap a bit. Some people sleep all the time. Some people, you know, treat it like a concert and listen all night. And I think that's one of the nice things about the piece is it sort of allows people to find their own way through it.
And you have a singer.
Yeah.
And she's soprano Grace Davidson. Let's hear a little bit from one of the movements in which she performs. Consult with any experts on the brain and sleep patterns in the brain?
Sure, yes. I called up a friend of mine, David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist. We talked a little bit about, you know, this spectrum that I've already mentioned, and also about the kinds of research that's been done to do with supporting various sort of cognitive processes via sound. People have been working with using low-frequency repetitive sounds to support kind of memory consolidation and learning and that kind of thing, which is pretty exciting. Yeah.
So a certain tone can help you remember things better?
In a way, yes. It's the fact of repetition. Basically, low frequency repeated events can kind of support this slow wave sleep, which is where memory gets turned into information, into long-term memories.
Why do you think we're having so much trouble sleeping?
We're just wired, you know. We're really wired. We're just on all the time. We've got this sort of chronic fear of missing out. And I think it's harder and harder for us to switch off. You know, we live in this sort of neoliberal, late-stage capitalist vision of humanity. You know, we're thought of as like objects which produce and consume. And that's squeezed out a lot of our bigger humanity in a way.
that part of LA downtown has a lot of homeless people sleeping out on the streets.
Exactly.
And probably in and around Grand Park regularly. Did you think about that sort of, I guess, the juxtaposition between them and the fact that they're sleeping outside, not necessarily voluntarily, and then the fact that you're charging people $60 to $80 to sleep on a cot?
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. I mean, obviously, I'm not from LA, so I, you know, it's relatively new information for me, but I have thought about that. And I mean, a piece like this is in a sense, yes, it's fraught with paradox, isn't it? Here we are charging people to experience an art event overnight, and yet there are people there sort of next door with nothing and nowhere to sleep for real. I guess my aspiration is for the piece, like really all cultural products, is that they speak to, you know, our larger viewpoint of what life is and should be, and can offer a kind of a little catalyst into thinking about these things.
Do you think that maybe they would think more about people who are
sleeping? I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, music, artworks are ways to think about the bigger questions of society and why we do what we do.
This is the first time you're performing it outdoors, right? How do you expect it to be different?
Well, the big thing about being outdoors is we have the night sky, you know, which is the most, one of the most magical things. And we also have sunrise, you know, the dawn, which is, you know, the other magical thing. So those are both really wonderful to have as part of, you know, part of this performance. It's very special to do it outdoors.
And the music itself, will it change as the night progresses? Will you lull people to sleep and then come, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning? Will there be a big fanfare?
Not quite. Yeah, but it, in a way, the piece does respond to the time. It's a kind of big set of variations which evolve across the 8 hours. For the first 7 hours or so, the spectrum of the piece is very reduced. So there are no high frequencies at all. And the spectrum mimics the acoustic environment of a baby in the womb. So what we hear is approximately what the unborn baby would hear. And then towards the end of the piece, it sort of brightens up. The spectrum opens up as dawn approaches. So that there's a kind of sunrise in the music.
Max Richter, composer of Sleep, which is being put on by the Music Center this Friday and Saturday night at Grand Park. All right, Christian Bordahl.
Wakey, wakey, Madeline Brand.
Strangely relaxed. How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm feeling good. I asked listeners, though, how much sleep they're getting, because I was kind of curious. 22% said they're getting less than 6 hours a night. 51% said 6 to 7 hours. 24% said 7 to 8. And only 3% more than 8. So we're not getting enough sleep, people.
That is no surprise.
Yeah, we got to listen to the music.
At all. Maybe we should go camp out in Grand Park. Okay. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. And not sleeping. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.